Barfield. I'm a local cannabis activist, educator, and researcher, and I am joined by my co-host, Uncle Dig, who is a cannabis activist and podcaster down in Oregon. How you doing today, Uncle Dig?
I am doing great, and I am relieved that we are only dealing with some normal ish summer heat as opposed to, apocalypse level summer heat up here in the Northwest. I don't know about you, but it was nearing up 116 where I'm at.
Wow. I don't think we quite made it up to that. I think they said they topped off at 108 yesterday in Seattle, but they were saying maybe 111 here in Tacoma. You know, when I was outside, and I have to tell you, I have not felt heat like that since I was in southern Texas or New Mexico. It was really hot, and I'm glad it's passed too, and I had to really water my cannabis plants. I was a little concerned though, because I have I just have one plant growing outside this year, and I was just a little concerned that I was going to water it too much and it was going to bake the roots a little bit. And so I just watered it lightly, but I'm staying up on my watering, and I'm trying to keep the leaves nice and moist to make sure that the get a little evaporation to cool them down. What kind of stuff are you doing with your plants down there in that 116 degree temp?
Well, it only got that. It only got like that for about 15 minutes, and then it was a spike. It sustained about 111, 112, like you were saying. But the high in my thermometer in my backyard was 116. Now, other people got different readings. That thermometer's over a concrete pad, so it might have had an effect on it. But it was up in the 110s regardless. It was way too hot. So with my bigger plants in the 30 gallons, I had to water them full watering twice that really hot day. I went out there really early and watered them with about 3 gallons each pot. And then in the evening, I had to give them 2 gallons just to keep them from completely drying out and wilting. I sprayed them off in the morning with a mist of water for the evaporation. And also that's a good like anti-aphid, pest thing. A lot of times the spray is enough to knock off your harmful pest insects. But a lot of times the beneficials are a little stronger, so they'll be able to survive and cling on. So that's a good way of kind of keeping your plants clean. Also, we've been having some wildfire smoke coming through from down in Northern California, so I also make sure to spray off the plants when that's going on too. So every other day during the summer, I'm usually spraying off my plants anyway. Now, my autoflowers completely dried out and started wilting.
Oh, wow.
During the heat, because they're in 3 gallons. And they're in their stretch and flower, so it's probably the worst time for it to get really hot. So I had to water those deeply twice, and they dried out completely by the end of the night. It was kind of crazy.
Those 4 gallon plants, you really got to keep things watered, because those roots will just suck that water right up into that plant.
Oh, yeah, but you know my tomatillos and my peppers, I had hail last week, I think on Tuesday.
Oh, wow,
And it was really bad. Usually we don't get hail, we get sleet out here, but we got like some good like little like almost, I don't know what you'd call it, like in between a ping pong ball and like smaller than a golf ball. It was, I don't know, like.
Yeah, about the size of a nickel, yeah.
Yeah, like nickel or maybe dime-sized hail. And it just tore through my plants.
Oh, wow.
Messed up my peppers and stuff. I was able to get my autoflowers undercover, but I didn't want to risk going back out in the hail because it was still getting bigger. But everything's recovering. It didn't manage to kill any of my plants. It killed one of my sunflowers, but all my other plants survived. And now my cannabis plants are starting to recover from that, but they didn't really get a break. You know, they got shredded by the hail. And then they got just beat down by this heat. But in the morning and the evening, when it was a little cooler, they're still doing that crazy thing where they grow. So I've got, since Tuesday, I've got probably about 6 inches on most of the plants of new undamaged growth since the hail. So we're in the summer stretch, guys. So get ready for monstrous growth this heat, because it's only going to shut off on the top part of the day when it's like 108, you know, and the plants really don't, you know, their vascular systems kind of don't want to work like they normally do. Even if they've got water, they don't really uptake it right. But once they get down below 100 again, which is still the majority of part of the day, they just love that upper 90s, just stretch and praying. So, I mean, my plants are killing it.
Yeah, because they love to, and that's a little trick that you do inside. You can water your plants from underneath in a pot. And what happens is those roots will chase the water, and then that causes the top of the plant to grow. So this really is a time for the plant to be stretching. Now, here in Washington, our stretch usually kind of is at the end of July, the 1st of August, because that's when it gets really hot. June is really just kind of a not do too much, because right now, usually in June, we're having a lot of rain, and so we don't get a ton of growth in June here on our outdoors, but we're getting it going this year, and those roots are stretching, and it's really neat to hear those autoflowers going coming along, and we'll be looking forward to a garden update on some of those autoflowers you have coming along pretty soon, Dig.
Yeah, and one thing that I wanted to say about growing, like, in June down here, so up there it's a little cooler in Washington. Down here in Southern Oregon, it gets pretty hot. If you're in a hotter climate, you really need to be in the ground, like, at the latest June 15th, or your seedlings will have trouble establishing a solid root ball because it'll just get too hot too often. You want to give them, like, a good, like, stretch of, like, 80 or 90 degree days to establish their root ball before you start nailing into the upper 90s and 100s.
Yeah, because if those roots can't stretch and get some water, it'll just kill the plant. Matter of fact, I think somebody gave me some tomato plants recently. I tried to get them in the ground. It was a little late, and that heat hit, and I think it probably just killed them off. So you got to get your plants in the ground June to June 15th at least, so they can get that root ball going and they'll be safe from all this heat. But we are going to get, speaking of heat, we're going to get into our first story, and that's right on down into Nevada, into the desert, down to everybody's, the world's most favorite city, they say, Las Vegas. And there's a new attraction in Vegas, Dig. Not only do they have the shows and all the casinos and everything, they are about to have cannabis social consumption lounges, which I have to say, maybe I was just a little optimistic, but I just assumed, and when the legalization came along, that this was something that is just going to come right along with it. It's like a no-brainer. People
now get stay home in your shame, stoner.
Yeah, people get together to consume cannabis. That's what you do. Back in the day when you go into the underground cannabis marketplace, you go over to the person's house, you always stopped, consumed some cannabis, and you left, and you went and consumed more cannabis with your friends. And I just always assumed that that's what's just going to be coming along, but it's not. And so, actually, Las Vegas is one of the first cities, or Nevada is one of the first states to open this up. And it's really good news going on down there.
Now, I will temper everyone excited, right? It temper everyone's excitement a little bit. We've heard this story before, right?
Like, yeah. This is their third attempt.
They've tried it in 2017 and 2019, but I think maybe this is the year. This new law would allow up to 70 cannabis lounges statewide. And if we make it to October 1st, 2021, that's when the new law takes effect.
Yeah, but hopefully there won't be some kind of lawsuit or something. There's always lawsuits of people trying to stop it. But this one looks like it might, because I think Nevada, like a lot of states, already has cannabis bans. So like a city that doesn't want cannabis lounges, they don't have dispensaries there already. So I think that this is already kind of going to keep itself inoculated from lawsuits, let's say that. And maybe it'll go forward now. From here to October 1st in cannabis policy is an eternity. But we hope that this can go forward. And I have to tell you, I might get on down to Vegas. I've never really considered going to Vegas. I'm not big into gambling. But maybe this thing, I might go down there and check that out.
Yeah, maybe. It might be cool. Me and my wife have like looked into going to Vegas. And honestly, most of the attractions there like don't really appeal to us. Except maybe some of the shows. But like, I could see a show someplace closer than Vegas.
Yeah, that's kind of how I feel about it. But maybe we'll get down there. I'm more of a New Orleans guy, but we might get into Vegas one of these days. And speaking of big shows and things that are going on nationwide and actually really popular things in the United States, so let's talk about the NFL for a minute. Now, I didn't know, Dig, that the NFL, so we're getting an article out of Forbes, but I didn't know that the NFL only generates about $15 billion a year, which, as we know and we're learning, the cannabis industry is way above that. So actually, the cannabis industry is dwarfing the NFL with the money they're bringing in.
Yeah.
And the NFL has decided to kind of say, take notice of that, and they're actually going to be offering $1 million grants to people to research cannabis and to try to find alternatives to opioids. And I think this is even better news than the social lounges.
I think this is really good that, like, look, regardless of, like, because first of all, what we got to say, everything about the NFL with a caveat, right? Brain damage for profit. All that being said, right, with what we know about, you know, pro football and brain damage, you know, it's good that they're investing research in something that's been shown to ameliorate some of the worst symptoms of brain damage, right? And if they can find research into that, they may be able to use certain targeted cannabinoid therapies to target certain, like, root causal damage of those, you know, TBI and brain damages that cause the issues. Like, because there's some evidence that, like, certain, like, CBD, CBN, and all these cannabinoids that we know what they do, but there's like 80 or 90 that we still haven't fully investigated.
Right, yeah.
So any more research into these, like, lesser known or more obscure cannabinoids is going to lead to new kinds of therapies that we can't really conceive of yet, because we don't really know what these new, you know, chemicals do.
Yeah, and I think this will help out a lot on the acceptance of cannabis, too. A lot of people in the quote-unquote mainstream out there, they take a lot of cues from places like the NFL. They look to NFL. You saw the whole thing with the whole knee debacle and that whole thing and the flag and everything with Colin Kaepernick. A lot of people kind of look to the NFL to form their worldview, believe it or not. And so this, even the NFL mentioning cannabis and saying they are accepting this a little bit more, I think is really good news, and it will help bring maybe just a couple more people onto the side of, hey, maybe this isn't just a bunch of stoners. This is actually helping out these NFL players. And I think, like you said, there is some evidence that if a football player was to get a TBI on the field and he was immediately taken to the locker room and given some high doses of THC and CBD, that could really help with concussions and things like that. And so this good they're studying this, because it can help with just regular medical problems like somebody getting in a car accident.
And speaking of help and aid to your fellow man, there's a really cool story out of Virginia that we want to talk about real quick.
Yeah, yeah. Go ahead with that, Dig.
The Virginia Marijuana Justice Organization. Virginia Marijuana Justice Organization, the VAMJ, is giving away seeds July 1st from 12 p.m. to 2 p.m. There's an online registration things for Virginia residents, and they're going to give everyone out free cannabis seeds the day that you're allowed to grow in Virginia. Isn't that amazing?
That is awesome, and it just would be great if we'd see this more places. But yeah, you can grow four plants in Virginia, but you know, there's three ways. There's cloning by seeds, and there's another way, it's not coming to my mind right now, it's what's that called when you anyway, let's forget about
it. Oh, tissue culture.
There
that
you
really
go. The
like
tissue
crazy
culture.
One.
Yeah, it's when you can like make like 100 plants at one time. I don't know much about it. That's why there was like that stall there. But yeah, tissue
well,
culture.
Well, I don't really understand tissue culture either. I'm going to poorly explain this. But basically, instead of, you know, a cutting is just a cutting a large enough piece of a plant to root. People have been doing that for a long time with plants.
Yes.
Probably as long as people have been cultivating, people have been taking cuttings of plants, right? A lot of roses, just like a lot of species, cultivars of cannabis, are cutting only, right?
Yep.
There's no seeds. You have to have a cutting. Well, tissue culture is like an extreme version of that. They take a little bit of tissue from the plant and then culture more cells until it makes a whole new plant. And why this is specifically useful, at least from my perspective, is that they can clean up genetics that have some plant diseases. So if you've got, if your whole run of like a clone-only cannabis strain that no one has anymore has like what's a plant disease that cannabis might get, like tobacco scale or tobacco. There's a tobacco virus that cannabis can get. That's kind of rare, but it gets it and it becomes systemic and you can't get rid of it by cloning or anything else. But apparently tissue culture gets rid of some of these systemic diseases and problems. So it's a way to clean up genetics that we couldn't clean up prior. So that's what's neat about it.
Yeah, and another cool thing is you can buy these on Amazon, so it's not that hard to do. I don't mess with it because it takes a lot of sterility, and blind people and sterility don't mix. But I find it very interesting, and you can just grow massive amounts. And this is a something that's been going on in the just regular plant world for a long time, but it's just coming to cannabis. One of the cool things I found about it, though, is you could actually take a tissue from a plant and put it on a Petri dish. You can set it up on the shelf for a couple of years in a refrigerator and then bring it out and start it up again. So you can actually save plant cultivars. Let's say you get tired of growing plant B. You want to keep it around, but you don't have a way. You can just cut a little piece, put it in the fridge, and put these chemicals on it, and it'll preserve it. So, yeah, back to the seeds, though. So there's only those three ways to get a cannabis plant going. And so Virginia is like – These organizations are saying, hey, we need to get more people seeds because it's not easy to get access to a cannabis clone. I know here in Washington it's not easy, and out there in the on the East Coast or down South, it's probably near about impossible to get cannabis clones. So this is a very great idea to get that kind of jumpstart the Virginia cannabis market.
And I would say that's a really good argument for not settling for a legalization bill that doesn't include home grow. Because I don't know if you remember this, but when they legalized in Washington back in the day, they said, oh, you know, we'll get to home grow. And you still can't buy a clone in Washington. And you still can't grow at home.
No, and so, we're still fighting for home grows. HomeGrowWashington.org, by the way, if you want to get out there and check that out. Yeah, we still can't do home grows in Washington. And, speaking of home grows, New Mexico, you can grow 6 plants starting today in New Mexico, Dick.
Congratulations, New Mexico.
Yeah, speaking of home grows, that is moving forward. And actually, there's been 5 states this year that have gotten cannabis bills going through the legislature, and they all, I'm pretty sure, I'm still not one, I should know this, but I'm still not 100% sure if New Jersey has home grows, but I know Connecticut does. All these states are going along with home grows, and New Mexico is actually raising some of their home grow limits for patients and everything. So it's not all doom and gloom out there, as we cover a lot. Some of these things are moving along great, and congratulations to New Mexico and Virginia for getting their cannabis industries going on a good note.
Yes, it's so awesome.
So speaking of legalization, we're going to move over to Germany and over to Europe. I'm just talking about over in Germany, and Germany is known for its democratic socialist leanings, and it's it has a lot of political parties and known for their cars and their industry. But there was just not a lot of word out of Germany a lot about the topic of cannabis. Although, it's according to a new study, 1 in 3 Germans have used or smoked cannabis before. And so these high usage numbers are actually leading to politicians over in Germany picking up cannabis as a issue in some upcoming elections.
Yeah, and it's interesting. So first thing you have to understand about European politics, their political names do not mean the same thing. So a lot of things may be called social democrat, socialist, green. That doesn't mean the same here, so let's not all get our dander up when I read these names, right?
Right.
But a couple of representatives from the Green Party and the Social Democrats and the Left Party in Germany all agree. Now, this is a left coalition in Germany, agree that prohibition are a failure. And the FDP, which is the Green Party's spokesman, Weiland Schinnenberg, basically told DW, which is the website we're reading off of, that there are estimated 4 million regular cannabis users in Germany, and their fates are being left to the ruthless forces of the black market, where there are no quality standards. And quality standards are very important to Germans.
Yeah, and it's an issue. Cannabis is the most popular so-called illegal drug over in in Europe and even in Germany. But like they were saying, is they have no control over it. And there's no capture of the tax dollars. And I think that Green Party is kind of more of a I don't want to say right, but they're more business friendly, they said. So it's real interesting that, and it kind of sounded to me kind of like a Republican Party of sorts. Kind of sounded to me that was real interesting to them, because the Republican Party, we're learning over here in the United States, is running away from cannabis. But other places, it's some of the, and we did a story a couple weeks ago about a more libertarian party in France picking up cannabis legalization, because to a lot of these, I think you mentioned this, a lot of these European sort of leaning to the right parties, they are still more invested in personal freedoms, kind of like a libertarian here, than let's say like a mainstream Republican Party is.
Well, and you got to remember, if we're going to talk about European politics, right, there's that whole leftist libertarian thing that we don't really have a lot of here in America, socialist. Like anarchists, like anarcho-socialists, libertarian socialists, people like that, that would be really hard-pressed to find someone in any sizable numbers in America that view the world through that lens.
Right, so we're going to wait and see. There's no like any kind of proposal or anything on the table to legalize cannabis in Germany, but when you start to seeing things like this churning in the media, it means they're going somewhere. So something's about to be coming along. We will keep an eye out on that. All right, and we are back on the Cannabis Corner. Uncle Dig and I, and we are here with our interview for this week, and we are joined by Tahir Johnson, and Tahir is the leader of the Social Equity and Diversity Department, I think it is, over at the U.S. Cannabis Council. And how you doing today, Tahir?
I'm good. How you guys doing today?
We're doing most excellent.
Yeah, we're doing really good today, and we want to have you on today to talk about cannabis social equity and something that I had not really heard a lot about, actually these specific terms used when we're talking about cannabis social equity, and that is cannabis redlining and redlining in the cannabis industry. And this is something that is emerging as a big problem that we're seeing, and that is on top of just the whole idea of social equity issues, which is that a lot of black and brown people have been left out of the cannabis industry due to a whole lot of systemic issues. So I want to have Tahir on today to kind of lay out this picture for us. And so we're going to get really started here and have him, Tahir, tell us a little bit about some of the systemic issues and some of the problems that have led up to all these issues we're seeing now that cannabis is becoming more legal around the country.
Sure thing. Well, first I'll say it's good to be talking to you guys in Tacoma, Washington, from across the country in Washington, D.C. And you brought up a really good point. And just really to talk a little bit, first to talk a little bit about social equity, to give a little bit of background for people that may not understand, is social equity is really the idea that cannabis, where we focus on, social justice, economic opportunity, really to make sure that the industry is, providing equality and opportunities to be prosperous for everyone, despite, race, race, sex, gender, all of those things. And so a lot of the conversation is repairing the harm that was done by the war on drugs. And when you talk about the war on drugs, you have a situation where black and brown communities were disparately impacted. Some of the statistics say, for example, from the ACLU said that African Americans are about 3.7 times more likely on a national average to be arrested for cannabis. But then when you turn around and look at participation in the industry on an ownership level, African Americans only have about 2% ownership within the industry. So the idea that you what you brought up and talked about redlining, what I would describe that as is really just the concept that when you look at the cannabis, because it's so cash intensive and we don't have access to capital at all, right? Because cannabis is federally illegal, there's no access to banking services. You can't go get a loan like if you wanted to start any other business. So the impact of that is that if you're not connect, if you don't have access to private equity, venture capital, or some type of general source of personal wealth, then you really can't participate in the industry. And the reason that disparately impacts African-Americans and Latino communities is really because if you look at the wealth gap that already exists in this country, it just widens it and makes it so that people who have been victimized and criminalized cannot turn around and participate in the same thing that's now being made legal. And so that's what I would kind of describe that as.
And that's an excellent point. And now as we come into this era of, you know, of legalization, some people, you know, call it like, you know, legislation, depending on where you're at and what they're doing with the plan and how open up it is. But how is social equity continuing to get left behind from the start as we run up these legal programs?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the ways it is left behind is that, you know, now we're at a place where many of the recent states where cannabis has been legalized, like New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, Virginia, for example, social equity has been a big part of the conversation. But the problem that you have, I guess a good example, you could say Illinois, right? So there were applications for dispensary licenses that would open up, but the ones that, you know, they none of those are actually open yet, right? So operators in Illinois had a 2-year head start now and a huge industry before social equity operators get to open up. Or you could look at somewhere like Colorado, where cannabis has been legal since 2014, and they're just now getting around to having, you know, social equity legislation is, you know, being part of it now. So the industry is going on to be a $20 billion a year industry in the country, and like I said, we have very little participation from minority communities.
Yeah, and that has been a criticism that we hear here in Washington State. We have a social equity program that's kind of limping along. My representative Melanie Morgan has been working on this, and there's been some really great work on the issue. And actually, Seattle is just now coming out with a social equity program, but. Talk a little bit more about how you just mentioned how these things have just all of a sudden they're like, oh, I think we left all these people behind. I think this is something that we didn't get to. Talk a little bit about more of the criticism that is exactly what's happening, that African Americans and Latino communities and indigenous communities, they're just kind of being handed out the scraps of what's left over after everybody's kind of come in and colonized the cannabis industry.
Right. Well, you know, I think, you know, and the way I kind of think of it, I think as people, the kind of, as we look at the way the cannabis industry and even the movement for legalization is maturing, I think initially when it started out, people were thinking about freeing the plant, right? They were just like, okay, I think the ground level, they were like, okay, we need to stop locking people up for this. We don't need to, nobody should be getting charged for something that is legal, right? So if we talk about social equity, that's like the ground floor. But now as the industry progresses and it's actually become an industry, right? Like, because once you legalize it, it's not just free. There's a whole system of commerce, economics that gets built around that. And it's important to be able to participate in that too, right? So it's not enough just to say, okay, we're not going to lock you up for this anymore, but we're going to make billions of dollars. I think it's important for those same communities to have some restorative justice. And an important aspect of it is something that we're really seeing play out now. I think that conversation started in Illinois, but the idea that restorative justice isn't just ownership or saying, you know, we want to have dispensaries, but now also money from the cannabis tax revenue being able to go back into those same communities, whether it's for schools or art programs or drug prevention or different things like that, right? Because this idea that now that we are building an industry, multi-million dollar or billion-dollar industries, it's important that entrepreneurs from those same communities now have the opportunity to participate, but also that revenue can go back to repairing and restoring those communities as well.
So those are excellent, like, regulatory solutions to this. And I was among one of those people that thought, okay, if we just make it legal and then the cops can't mess with anyone and then it'll work itself out, right? Well, that clearly hasn't happened. And now moving forward, as someone who's not a big big dog in the industry, but who is a consumer? You know, what can a consumer do? We've got all these regulatory things, but what can I do as an individual to help support social equity, you know, these businesses?
Sure. I think one of the biggest things, there's you know, great thing you can always do is call your legislator, let them know that you want to see these type of regulations. But really, man, as a consumer, the biggest thing that you can do is support with your dollars and having conscious spending habits. I know that Leafly, Weed Maps, they both have nail waves where you can identify. I know where they're doing it, like identify social equity operators that they have on their platform. You know, really just being able to spend those dollars in those communities. And if you, like, again, if you're in a local dispensary, if you know of any minority owned brands, asking for them, saying that you want to, you know, see them on the shelf. That's a great way that you can support as a consumer.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. So let's talk about federal legalization real quick. So they have the MORE Act and then they have the Safe Banking Act they're trying to put out. And there's also a bill to regulate insurance for the cannabis industry. How do you think something like the MORE Act will help promote social equity? And do you think they should change anything on the federal legalization effort to kind of make social equity a little bit more of a forefront to the legalization movement as we go forward?
Sure. Well, you know, one of the good things about the MORE Act is, you know, it does have the intent that it's going to provide those economic opportunities. There's a fund that operators will be able to have access to for capital. Again, like cannabis being federally legalized does so many things where, you know, where again, it will provide access to banking, access to capital. It will have it where, you know, across the country, there's no more people being arrested or locked up for cannabis, having their lives ruined for those types of things. And, you know, one of the things I'll say, the MORE Act last year when it was initially introduced, there were some things in there like if you had a felony, then you could have been restricted from being able to potentially have a, you know, get a license because you would have to, like, a federal licensing system. And I know that that was removed this time around. So, you know, again, the MORE Act is probably as far as what's come out right now. Well, the only, you know, it's probably been in terms of social equity, probably been the most progressive that we have. But we've seen a number, I mean, from a social equity standpoint, but we're seeing a number of, you know, a number of efforts towards legalization. And as you mentioned, safe banking is something that was included in coronavirus relief bills multiple times. You know, it was voted on. So the Safe Banking Act is one that I think is really important because even without legalization, and I'll say that the reason safe banking is so important is out, and I find it to be a nonpartisan issue, is because whether you are for cannabis legalization or not, you're for social equity or not, I think one of the things that giving access to banking does is, for one, from a public safety issue, you don't have these cannabis businesses that have to deal in cash, you know, having cash on site. But then from an economic standpoint, opportunities that it will create for minority and small businesses, you know, by being able to go in a bank, being able to get access to capital, is something that can really be a game changer for a lot of people. So, you know, I think that that's going to be really important as well. And the safe banking, again, when you talk about those, like we talked about, minority communities that don't typically have access to capital, being able to fund your business that way will go a long way.
And this is Uncle Dig, and I just want to highlight something he mentioned there. The Safe Banking Act is a big step that could happen in social equity and cannabis, but the public safety aspect is very important, right? Cannabis is a high-value crop. You sell it for decent money, and all these businesses are dealing in cash, and at least a lot of early on in legalization, a lot of people know that these businesses deal in cash, and there is a spike in armed robberies that could be easily avoided if they just legalize safe banking.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, and you think about the risk that, you know, just the risk to dispensary employees. Like, I used to work at a dispensary, and it was something It felt very similar to, and I worked in banking before I transitioned to cannabis, and I'll tell you, walking out of a dispensary at night, you kind of get the same feeling as you get walking out of a bank, because like you said, you know, it's in all cash and everybody knows it. Anybody that's a customer there knows that they pay in cash, so.
Yeah, and that's a good segue. I noticed you worked in finance. I was looking at your bio, and then how did you come to work in the cannabis industry from finance?
Sure. So I was, I've been a long time cannabis consumer, and I guess I would say part of the culture. But in terms of banking and my introduction to the legal cannabis industry, it actually all happened in a couple of different ways at the same time, kind of like the perfect storm. First was my dad. My dad got diagnosed with fibromyalgia, and he had to take a medication called prednisone and like a couple other things that were kind of really, causing different types of side effects. Mm. And I remember doing a paper in college about medical cannabis. And I was like, hey, Dad, I think you should try medical marijuana to try to help you with this instead. And he's like, son, I've been smoking weed since the 60s. There's nothing you could tell me about it. And I'm like, no, I really think you should try it. And so I said, if you go get your medical card, I'll go get mine with you. And so that was my first time visiting a dispensary, kind of seeing the way everything worked. And I just started, I just got so curious about it that I started researching, learning everything I could. I went to Oaksterdam University, Cannabis Training University online. And as I really started finding out about the issue that we've been talking about here, where minorities don't have access to capital and that being a challenge in the industry, I wanted to come try to use my expertise to help out and solve that problem. So I ended up starting a few different cannabis businesses and also applied for licenses myself in New Jersey, where I grew up, and Maryland, where I live now. And that was my start to getting in the cannabis industry. And just through, I'll say, man, from finance, one of the things that I was always really good at was networking. And as I started making my way around the industry, I made a bunch of different relationships and started working at the National Cannabis Industry Association. And that led me to the work that I'm doing now at Marijuana Policy Project and U.S. Cannabis Council. But like I said, it was me when I found out about just the industry. I ended up quitting my job, I guess, and had to backtrack a little bit. So while I was working at the bank, the local dispensary in my neighborhood where I was a patient, I ended up starting to work there. So I was working part-time at the dispensary and at the bank at the same time. And I fell in love with it so much that I decided that this is what I wanted to do and quit the bank. So that was in January 2019, and I haven't looked back since.
Yeah, that's a great story. I interviewed another person, Jim Parco, who was in the Air Force, and he was in cannabis, but he had a kind of a similar story how his parents got sick, and they were actually kind of the same thing, taking prednisone, and they had all these massive outbreaks of side effects, so they went to cannabis, and now he's all in the cannabis industry too. So great story there. And I wanted to talk real quick, since you brought it up, Oaksterdam University and Cannabis Training University. I actually wrote some articles for CTU there for a while, and I teach a cannabis course here in Tacoma at Tacoma Community College on cannabis too. Let's talk a little bit about how cannabis education and how actually bringing cannabis more into the mainstream and getting it more into our schools is actually part of the curriculum. How do you think that can help social equity in bringing more African Americans and Latinos into the cannabis industry?
Oh my gosh, man! I think that is one of the biggest things that we can do. Education is so critical, especially because in our communities there's a stigma around cannabis. If you think about something where for the past 50 years, our people have been over policed, arrested for, and now it's legal. There's a real hesitancy for people to explore the industry and others understand it. But even also this idea that the cannabis industry is so much larger and there's so many more opportunities than just owning a dispensary or cultivation, right? If you're educated around it, if you're an attorney or you're in marketing or, if you're a doctor, there's opportunities for you to be in the cannabis industry. And if you're educated about the opportunities, really knowing about the ancillary side, then I think that there's ways that you can really get into the industry and participate that may even be better for you.
Yeah, like you know, not, you know, like gardening supplies that specialize to the plant, stuff like that that people don't really think about. There's tons of different ways to work with the plant and work with people that work with the plant without ever putting a seed in the ground. That's a fair point. Yeah.
Talk to cannabis attorneys and, you know, man, I could architects and construction folks and lobbyists and, man, the list just goes on so long. And whatever scale you probably have professionally, there's definitely a way, more than likely, that you could bring it over to the cannabis industry, especially if you're in one of these new markets. So, if you know, I think that people that really want to look for opportunities should really, I shout out Oaksterdam and Cannabis Training University all the time, because going and getting that type of perspective of the industry early on helped me to kind of really have a high level view and understanding of it. I would definitely recommend it to anybody that wants to pursue opportunities in the industry.
Cool. And I understand you got their indoor grow certification. I think I saw that on your LinkedIn.
I do. Yeah, I do. I do have the indoor grow certification. I do a little bit of growing on my own.
Awesome. We love to hear that people are able to home grow. So anytime someone is home growing, we want to highlight that on the show for sure.
Oh yeah, man. I mean, I think it's such an important skill to have, man. Having that connection to the plant, being able to grow is just such a common thing, man.
Yes, and I think it understanding the work that goes into the plant can deepen your appreciation for it even further. What else are you working on? What are you working on currently? Do you have a website or a Twitter we can direct people to come check you out at?
Yeah, sure. So the website for U.S. Cannabis Council is uscannabiscouncil.org. My personal on all social media is my name, but it's Todd Diddy, TahDiDdy, and that's on Instagram and Twitter. Like I said, I also have a podcast myself called The Cannabis Diversity Report, and that lives on thecannabisdiversityreport.com. And so I've had some great episodes talking to different types of minority operators discussing their lanes in the industry as well.
All right, Tahir. Well, thank you so much for coming on, and we really appreciate it. There's a lot of great information there. I would encourage the audience to go check out the U.S. Cannabis Council and the other websites he gave out there, and follow him on Twitter and Instagram to keep up with everything that he has going on. And we'll probably have you back on one day, Tahir, to talk about some growing and stuff. We have Dig does a garden update, and I'm a medical grower too, kind of hobby grower, and that's one of our favorite issues to talk about is how to grow the cannabis plant. Like you guys were saying, it really gives everybody an appreciation if you can grow, and then it also kind of frees up the cannabis plant a little more so that the police aren't breathing down everybody's neck, because everybody can grow. So is there anything else you want to leave us with before we get out of here, Tahir?
No, it's just a pleasure catching up with you guys today. Looking forward to coming back on soon. Legalize it. My final words.
All right, so we're moving on to our final segment of the show, and that's our It's a Bus segment. And we are back to our favorite state of the country to talk about cannabis, and that is California. And it just seems like California is just having all over the place with this cannabis thing. And they are still busting people in California, and they just busted a massive grow down there. It was 15,000 plants. And I think if I read it right, 91.5 pounds of processed cannabis sitting around. And it's about 18 miles out of San Diego. What other details do you have on this big, massive cannabis bust, Dick?
Yeah, the details are kind of scarce. The main complaint that law enforcement mentioned, of course, there were safety issues, right? Unregulated grows have a lot of safety issues. So code enforcement has been going out to these illegal grows along with the law enforcement. Also, the article mentioned that they were diverting water in an illegal way. And basically, they were making some environmental arguments and environmental accusations. And I know that, you know, people often make the point that environmental regulations and grows are bad for the environment. And we've talked about this on the show, but you wanted to talk about law enforcement making these environmental arguments, right?
Yeah, it just seems odd to me that all of a sudden when the cannabis is involved, the sheriff department wants to talk about how they're being environmentally unfriendly. Although the police are never worried about, I mean, I'm a vegan, and police are never worried about a cow farm, and they're not going, and maybe they are in California, but I haven't heard them raiding cow farms polluting water. I haven't heard about them raiding refineries using up all the water. So, you know, it's just odd to me how the police and even regulators, they kind of like to use the environmental issue as a way to crack down on underground cannabis. And it is a concern. But actually, I got put in my place when I wrote one of my first cannabis articles was actually on cannabis being environmentally unfriendly out there on the underground market. And I had somebody just come in and say, hey, look here, compared to like oil or fossil fuels, cannabis is nothing. So,
I mean, even the environmentally damage of like modern policing practice, right? Like a lot of these less than lethal musicians are made up of small plastics.
Yep.
The tear gas poisons the immediate area around where they use it.
And they use it
too much. Whole parts of Portland right now, including like the waterways, are really messed up from police overuse of impact munitions and tear gas and the like. On the city streets and in the environment at large. So like, it's really interesting that they would bring that up, but not really hold themselves accountable to the same standard.
Right.
Now, putting on other people.
I'm just sticking with my usual thing on this, which is, go out there. I still contend that the government should actually work with these folks and say, okay, look at all this cannabis you're growing. Let's help you fix this where we can actually get you a license and give you a proper income and help these folks get regulated. Because guess what? They shut it down, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago. Whoever those folks are, they're somewhere across town starting up a new grow right now. As we speak right now, they are setting up again, and it's going to happen all over again. This is just proven time and time again.
Well, and also the problem in California, and also I would argue in Washington, is the taxes are so high that you know, in a capitalist society, you are de-incentivized from following the regulated market because the taxes are so high. You could actually make more money in the black market. And honestly, without the constrictions of regulation, a lot of times they're turning out a better product on the black market than on the legal market, which is ridiculous. It should not be the case.
No, it should not be the case.
It really makes me angry that they've created these legal systems almost in a way to fail, and they still refuse to acknowledge their shortcomings and trying to fix them.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And thanks for joining us today on the Cannabis Corner. We are about to get on out of here. My name is Lucas Barfield. If you'd like to get in contact with the show, you can send over an email to Radio Tacoma at info@radiotacoma.org. Put Cannabis Corner in the subject line, and they will get it over to us. And folks can also contact you, Dig, and listen to your podcast. Tell us about where we can find your cannabis stuff, Dig.
Yeah, you can check me out on Instagram at Uncle Dig, and you can listen to my podcast called The Bag Seed Chronicles with Uncle Dig, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Cannabis Corner, hosted by Lucas Barfield. If you would like to get in contact with your host, he is on Twitter at MJIsMedicine. Your musical selection is The Happy Monster by Chubby Jackson and his orchestra, recorded on 78 in 1947. You can find this music and much more at The Great 78 Project, an archive of historical music recordings at great78.archive.org. You are listening to 101.9 KTAH, Radio Tacoma.